morning, everyone. Thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here and to learn with everybody. So I'll start with a story. In 1958, a New York man named Robert Lane decided to call his baby son Winner. The Lanes, who lived in a housing project in Harlem, already had several children, each with a fairly typical name. But this boy, well, Robert Lane apparently had a special thing about this one, Winner Lane. How could he fail with a name like that? 3 years later, the Lanes had another baby boy, their seventh and last child. For reasons that no one can quite pin down, Robert decided to name this boy Loser. It doesn't appear that Robert was unhappy about the new baby. He just seemed to get a kick out of the name's bookend effect. First a winner, now a loser. But if Winner Lane could hardly be expected to fail, how could Loser Lane possibly succeed? Loser Lane did, in fact, succeed. He went to prep school on a scholarship, graduated from Lafayette College in Pennsylvania, and joined the NYPD, which was his mother's longtime wish. Although he never hid his name, people were uncomfortable using it. So I have a bunch of names, he says today, from Jimmy to James to whatever they want to call you, but they rarely call you Loser. Once in a while, he said, they throw a French twist on it, Lusier. To his cop friends, he's known as Lou. And what of his brother? The can't-miss name, and the most noteworthy achievement of Winner Lane, now in his mid-40s, is the length of his criminal record. Almost 36 arrests for burglary, domestic violence, trespassing, resisting arrest, and other mayhem. So though this story is pretty strange, it's definitely a concept in Jewish thought as well, that names are important and are often associated with what parents wish for a child, often connected to a previous generation's legacy, what a parent wants the child to carry on moving forward in the next generation. And it seems to be a focus in the opening of yesterday's Parsha, in Parsha Shmos. So if we look at source one, the Parsha opens, Ve'ela Shmot b'nei Yisrael haba'im Mitzrayimah et Yaakov isho v'tov va'u. So it opens up with the names of Yaakov and his family. And the Baal HaTurim on this pasuk comments in source number two, Ve'ela Shmot b'nei Yisrael haba'im Roshei Tevot Shivya. So if you look at the first letter of each word of those five words, of not Ve'ela, but of Shmot B'nai Yisrael Haba'im, Shmot Shin B'nai Bet Yisrael Yud Haba'im Hey, it's the Rashi Tivot, it's the abbreviation for the word Shivya, which means captivity. Sha'afil k'shahayu b'shivya Shmot B'nai Yisrael, Shmot B'nai Yisrael. So even when they were in captivity, even when they were in Golos, even when they were in exile in Mitzrayim, they still kept their Jewish names. Their names were still names of B'nai Yisrael. And then the Baal HaTurim quotes the Medrash, which we'll look at in source 3, Shalo Shinu Et Shmam. The Jewish people didn't change their names in Mitzrayim to Egyptian names. The Gamkein, Vav, Ve'ela Shmot, Vav Mosif Alinyan Rishon, the Baal HaTurim adds another comment that the Ve'ela Shmot, this is a new Sefer of Chumash, starting Sefer Shmot, you would think it would start with a new topic, but it starts with Vav, Ve'ela Shmot. It makes it sound like it's adding on something, it's continuing something from the previous story, from the previous Pasuk at the end of Sefer Bereishit. And that Vav, Ve'ela Shmot, and these are the names of Bnei Yaakov, it's adding on to a previous point of Vayama Yosef, of Yosef dying at the end of Sefer Bereishit. And the Baal HaTurim says, Ve'ela Shmot Shetziva Lahem Shelo Yishnu Shmotam. Apparently, Yosef commanded his brothers, the rest of his family, don't change your names. Ve'amar Lahem, and I apologize for the formatting here, it seems to have gone a little bit off. Ve'amar Lahem, that mem goes to the previous line. Afal pi sheshinu shmi, v'korinu tzi tzafnat panayach, atem al tishnu shmotam. Yosef says, even though I changed my name and I'm called Tzafnat Paneach in Mitzrayim, do as I say, not as I do, Yosef said. Don't follow in my ways and change your name. Don't change your names. And that's the Ve'ela Shmot is commenting on, is continuing from Yosef's death. Apparently, one of his dying wishes to his family was don't change your names. And the Midrash in Vayikra Rabbah, in source number 3, tells us, not only did Bnei Yisrael not change their names, but this was apparently very praiseworthy. Rav Huna Amar B'Shem Bar Kapra B'Shvil Dalid Zvarim Nigalu Yisrael Mimitzrayim. For four reasons, the Jewish people deserve to be redeemed from Mitzrayim. Shaloshi Nuet Shmam, they didn't change their names. Bet Lashonam, they didn't change their language. They didn't start speaking a foreign language. V'lo Amru Lashon Hara, they didn't speak Lashon Hara. They didn't gossip about other people. No one among them was promiscuous in an inappropriate way. So apparently it was praiseworthy and deserving of geula, deserving of redemption from Mitzrayim, that they didn't change their names. What I want to talk about today is why. What's so great about not changing their names? What's so bad about having a secular name? Why is this deserving of geula? And I want to look through some sources in halacha about, are we allowed to have secular names? Is it something that's allowed but really kind of frowned upon? Or is it something that's totally fine? Where does this all kind of, how does this all play out in Jewish law? And hopefully we'll also glean a message from that towards the end of the shiur. So if we look at, so what are some potential options of why it could be a problem to change their names, of why it would be praiseworthy that they didn't change their names, and what the problem would be? So option number one is that maybe it's a problem of a prohibition called chukot hagayim, right? Following in the ways of the non-Jews, doing practices that the non-Jews do, that's a prohibition in the Torah, from the pasuk of ubechukotayhem lo telechu, don't follow in the ways of the non-Jews and the rules of the non-Jews, and maybe it's a problem following in the ways of the non-Jews. So, if we, and that could really be interpreted in two ways. The way that prohibition kind of plays out could be developed in two ways, and we'll see that in the next two sources. So, if we look at source number four, the Rambam in Hilchot Avodah Zarah, the Rambam says, "Ein holchin b'chukot ha'avdei kochavim velo medamin lahen lo b'malbush velo b'sayar v'chayot ebehen." We don't follow in the rules of non-Jews of idol worshippers. Velo medamin lahen. We're not supposed to be similar to them, not in our dress and not in our hair, and anything like that. Shne'emar velo tzalchu b'chukot ha'goy, v'ne'emar b'chukotayim lo tzeleichu, v'ne'emar yishamer lecha penti nakish achareyem, hakol be'enyan echad, hu mazhir shelo yidameh lehen. He quotes three different psukim, but he says these are all getting at the same idea that we're not supposed to follow the rules of non-Jews, we're not supposed to follow in the ways of non-Jews. Now whenever I think about this topic, and whenever I learn through this topic, I always think to myself, of course we have to draw the line somewhere, we all breathe, we all walk and sleep and eat, of course it doesn't mean like we can't do anything that non-Jews do that wouldn't allow us to function or to exist. So we have to obviously draw the line somewhere, and the way that this halacha develops tries to understand, the way that the mefarshim and the commentaries and all the halachic authorities have tried to understand these psukim over the generations and these prohibitions have been trying to draw that line, trying to figure out where do we draw that line. It's also clear that it's not drawing the line at saying we can't worship idols, that we can't be similar to non-Jews in worshipping their gods, because that's a different issur, right? That's a different prohibition of avodah zarah, of idol worship, and that's not this. That's something else. So this has to be talking about something else. It's not actual idol worship, but something else. And the question is, where do we draw the line? And I think we'll see that in the next source. I just want to read a little bit more of the Rambam first. So the Rambam says we can't follow the rules of non-Jews, continuing on the end of the second line. Ella, right, it's also supposed to be connected to the previous line. I apologize for the formatting here. Ella, yeha Yisrael muvdal mehen, v'yadua b'malbusho, v'sha'ar ma'asav. Rather, what's the Jew supposed to do? Not be similar to the non-Jew, but be separate from the non-Jew and recognizable, right, known in his clothing and the rest of his ways. K'moshe hu muvdal mehen b'mada'o b'deyotav. Just as we are known, recognizable, and separate from the non-Jew in our thoughts, in our philosophy, and in our beliefs, we're supposed to also show that separation visibly through our clothing and through our hair and the way that we carry ourselves. That's what Hashem says, I'm going to separate you from the other nations. And again, he's quoting another pasuk to support the idea, don't wear clothing that's special for, that the non-Jews specially wear. He's going through the different hairstyles and explain, a mohawk is one example, and he says don't cut your hair the way the non-Jews do and don't dress like they do. Okay, I'm not going to read the rest of the Rambam inside. He's going through more examples of this. Now, one thing that he does not mention is what? Names, right? He doesn't talk about not having non-Jewish names specifically. He doesn't mention that, but you could argue that it would be under the v'chayotzei bahen, right? Under the, and things that are like this, right? Other activities that could be included in not being similar to non-Jews. Now, the Shulchan Aruch also codifies this halacha, and the Ramah, the Ashkenazi commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, he kind of summarizes for us the different ways that this halacha has been understood through the generation. So let's read that now in source number 5. Ein holchin b'chukot ha'avdei kochavim v'lo medamin lahen. The Shulchan Aruch says, quoting from the Rambam here, that we don't follow the rules of non-Jews and we're not supposed to be similar to them. V'lo yilbash malbush ha'miyuchad lahem. We don't wear clothing that's special for the non-Jews. V'lo yigadel tzitzit rosho kmo tzitzit rosham. Don't grow your hair the way that they grow it. V'lo yigaleach me'at tzadin v'yaniach hasay arba emtza. Don't shave the sides and leave hair in the middle like the mohawk. V'lo yigaleach hasay armi keneged panam me'ozen le'ozen v'yaniach hapera. Don't, another way to shave that you're not supposed to do. V'lo yivne mekomot kibinyan hechalot shel avdei kochavim kedei shekansu behem rabim. I'm on the third line of source number 5. You're not supposed to build big stadiums and amphitheaters that the non-Jews have where they gather lots of people, kimoshe mosim, and then Haggah. Okay, so the Rama here is introduced by Haggah on the third line, the last word on the third line of source number 5. Everyone with me? He says, Ela yehei muvdam lehem b'malbushav u'shar ma'asav. Rather, still quoting from the Rambam, you should be separated from them. You should be separate from them in your clothing and in other ways. But now the Rambam qualifies, and he gives us our line that we said we have to draw. V'kol ze eino asur ela b'davar shenahagu bo ha'avdei kochavim l'shum pritzut. All this is only talking about things that non-Jews do for the sake of pritzus, right, of promiscuity. It's not saying that you're not allowed to do anything that non-Jews do, you're just not allowed to do things that they do that are inappropriate, that are sexually inappropriate, that are promiscuous. Kegon shenahalgu lilbosh malbushim adumim. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of people not wearing red, so comes from this. I'm not saying in conclusion that you can't wear red. I think I'm wearing some red. But that idea, for those who end up interpreting it that way, comes from here, that you're not supposed to wear red clothes, v'hu ma'bush sarim, that it's the clothing of their officers, v'chadom elezem, ma'bushay ha'pritzot. Apparently, these are promiscuous types of clothing. So, A, what kind of things are we not allowed to do in imitating non-Jews are things that are promiscuous. And now the Rama adds, now I'm on the 5th line at the end of the line in source 5. O b'davar shenahagu leminhag v'lechuk v'ein ta'am b'davar de'ika l'michash be mishum derkei ha'amori v'yesh bo shemet avodat kochavim. Or, so you can't do it if it's pritzus, or you can't do it if it's just kind of like a rule that they have that seems to have no apparent reason. Why? What are we worried about if we're doing something that they do that has no apparent reason? Maybe it started with some connection to Avodah Zarah, and now it's not necessarily connected to Avodah Zarah or practiced that way, but maybe that's how it started. So that's why we can't do it, because if it has no apparent reason, maybe the original reason was something connected to idol worship, and that's obviously something we need to stay away from. So, you know, for example, like Halloween, let's say, is not necessarily something that people today observe in a religious way, that they know the connection to the, you know, the pagan ritual that it came from, but that might be something that would fall under this category. So Yayin Nesach is a type of prohibition that's connected to Avodah Zarah, right, that we can't have wine that might have been used as part of the idol worshipping service, and that's why, right, that we have the halacha of Stam Yinam, that we can't have wine that's not, you know, that doesn't follow all the rules and making sure that's not connected to idol worship, right, wine that's produced by non-Jew. Okay, so our two rules of where we draw the line for Hukos Hagayim are that we can't have things that are connected to pritzos, and we can't have things that have no apparent reason at all. So continuing on in the Rama here in source 5, in three lines up from the bottom, in the middle of the second word, aval davar shenahagu l'toeles, right, something that was a practice that has a purpose, kegon shadarkan shakol mi shehu rofei mumcha yesh lo mabush miyuchad shenikar bo shehu rofei uman. Right, for example, what's the example he gives of something that has a purpose? That doctors wear some sort of garment that shows that they're a professional doctor, that they wear a white coat, they wear scrubs, they wear something that identifies them as a professional, as a doctor. Mutar lelov sho. So that would be something that a Jew who's a doctor could also wear, because it has a purpose. Or anything that's worn for the person to be able to get respect, or for any other reason, mutar. Those are all permitted. Okay, so the Rama summarizes the literature that came before him to draw the lines with those two reasons. Those are the two things that would qualify as Hukos Hagayim. Now, when applying that, obviously, to different activities, different events, different scenarios, it's not always so clear what falls under those and what doesn't. It's not so black and white, but that's not really our topic for today. But in terms of names, it's not clear. I think one could say that using secular names could fall under that category of being similar to non-Jews, you know, for no apparent reason. But I think one could argue that there is a reason for people to have a secular name. It's easier for people to pronounce, right? If you live in a, you know, if you live in a country where people are not familiar with Hebrew, it's easier for people to pronounce your name. If you're going to the doctor's office, if you're on the phone with the insurance company, if you're applying to university, whatever it is, there is a reason, right? So maybe it's not a problem of Chukot HaGoyim. Nonetheless, so that's one option of what the problem could be, and we'll see as we continue on whether that's going to play out to actually be a problem. Now, the other potential problem that's brought up in the literature of what could be a problem of having a non-Jewish name, with having a secular name, comes from source number 6, which is a tshuva, a response of the Maharal Shaddam, who lived in the 1500s in Saloniki, and he was dealing with the following case. He deals in this tshuva with a question about Jews from Portugal who had escaped the Spanish Inquisition. And they how did many people escape the Spanish Inquisition? What did they do? They acted like non-Jews, right? They were crypto-Jews, or Muranos, as they're sometimes known. And what happened was, so in order to follow through on that, all these people took on non-Jewish names. And this rabbi was asked about whether these people, after they returned to the Jewish community, after the threat was no longer an issue, and they returned to Jewish community, and they returned to be practicing Jews, and they began to use their Jewish names again. But the question is, can they still use their non-Jewish names on their legal documents and on all the places that they had used it in the interim? Can they still use their names? Okay, so in the tshuva, we'll see what he concludes later on in the shir at the end, but in the tshuva he suggests another possible explanation for why it might be a problem to use a non-Jewish name. In source number 6, he says, right, even though it would apparently seem, and he's going to end up concluding that this isn't a problem, but I would just want to look now at what he suggests the problem could have been. He says, right, to bring a possible proof to prohibit this, based on what the Tur says, he's quoting now from the Tur, and again, I'm in source number 6 in the first line. Asur la'adam lomar shehu goy, kedei shelo yahar guhu. A person is not allowed to say that he's non-Jewish to save his life, so that he won't be killed. Kevan shehu omer shehu goy, hare model l'datam, v'kofer b'ikar. Because by saying he's a non-Jew, he's actually almost condoning and admitting to and to believing in their religion, and that's heresy, right, in a fundamental way. Ad Khan, that's the end of the quote from the Tur. And this is obviously also a very complicated issue, and we know historically that there were Jews who did this, like the Muranos and other situations. Right, there's a story actually in Exodus, and Exodus is historical fiction, so this might be a fictional story, but there's a story in the book of a scientist who was apparently very valuable to the Germans in World War II, and so they didn't want to send him off to the camps with the rest of his community. They wanted to keep him alive. But they couldn't do that with people knowing that he had Jewish heritage, connection to Jewish family, so they wrote up this fake document saying that he has no ties to the Jewish people, and all he had to do to save his life was sign this document. And in the story, in Exodus, he refused to do so, because he refused to go along with saying that he had no ties to the Jewish people. So maybe in that fictional story, he was following this halacha. And again, we know this is more complicated, but not our topic for today. What I want to see from here is that the Maharal Shaddam in this response is saying that he's quoting from the Torah that you're not allowed to pretend to not be Jewish, and where would that take us in terms of names, right? V'yomar, we're continuing now in the third line here, the middle of the line. V'yomar ha'omer d'hacha nami kevan shekorei atzmo b'shem goy havalei ke'omer shehu goy v'asur. Right? Maybe by calling yourself a non-Jewish name, we could take this halacha of not pretending to be a non-Jew a step further and say that you're not even allowed to call yourself a non-Jewish name, because that would be as if you're saying you're not Jewish, and that's prohibited. That's not allowed. So our options, to summarize so far, of why it might be a problem to take on a non-Jewish name would be, maybe it's chukos hagayim, right? It's following in the ways of non-Jews, which is not allowed, or maybe it's this other prohibition of pretending to be a non-Jew, and that's also not allowed. So those are our options of why it might be a problem. But if we continue on, And we see, okay, so if we continue on, we'll see some support in the Gemara and in the Rishonim that also seems to imply, in addition to our Midrash, about the Jewish people in Mitzrayim, that seems to support that this really isn't a proper thing to do. So if we look at verse number 7 in Masachet Gittin, the Gemara says, and when we're talking about Gittin, when we're talking about a get, names are very important, because it's very important that the get has the proper name, so that we know that it's this person getting divorced and not a different person, which has serious ramifications. So Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, in source number 7, the beginning of the line, of the first line, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Shalchule b'nei medinat hayam l'Ram Gamliel. So the people who were on the other side of the ocean, in foreign lands, sent to Ram Gamliel, and they had a question. They said, B'nei Adam haba'im misham l'kan, if there are people who are coming from there to here, right? So from Eretz Yisrael to exile, or from exile to Eretz Yisrael. Shmo Yosef v'korin lo Yochanan, Yochanan v'korin lo Yosef. And in one place he has one name, and in the other place he's known by a different name, right? I know this, when I was in college, I definitely had friends who for their entire lives they were Michal, and all of a sudden they're Michelle, right? In I went to Barnard. So now they're Michelle, right? And they never were Michelle before, they were always Michal, now they're Michelle. So if you're known in one place as one thing, and in another place as another thing, so, ha'ech migarshin, how are they supposed to get divorced, right? If they need to get divorced, what's their get supposed to say? Which name is it supposed to use? Ha'ech migarshin nishotayen, sorry, continue on to the next line. So, Amar Rabbi Gamliel v'hitzkin, Rabbi Gamliel got up and made a takana, he made a rule, sheyehei kotvin, ish ploni v'kol shum sheyeshla, isha ploni v'kol shum sheyeshla, that you write their name, and you say, and any other name that this person's known by, both for a man and for a woman, with Nate Tikkun Ha'olam, right? So that we make sure that nobody is getting confused, no one's making mistakes in terms of whose get this really is. Amar Rav Ashi qualifies that, and he says, Behuda it chazik betray shmei. This is talking about somebody who is really known by two names, okay, that you're supposed to do that. So if we turn the page and look at Tosfos here, in source number 8, Tosfos says, Behuda it chazik betray shmei, if he's known by two names, Sha'alu l'Rabinu Tam. Rabinu Tam was asked, Al mumar l'avodas kochavim, and someone who is a heresy to idol worship, a heretic to idol worship, right? He left Judaism and became an idol worshiper. Shagirish ishto, who divorced his wife. V'lo nechtav beget, ela shem shel yahadus, right? In this person's get, only his Jewish name was written. But he no longer considers himself a Jew, this person. He left Judaism and he goes by his non-Jewish name now. Right, the low shame shall Ovid Kochavim, and his non-Jewish name was not written in the get. So the question, does this get count? Is it valid? And Veheshiv Rabbeinu Tam, the early Balei HaTosfos, he answers, Chalila lahazkir shame Ovid Kochavim b'Torah Moshe v'Yisrael. God forbid we should write an idol worshiper's name, or the name of the idol worshiper in a get, right, in a Jewish document. So again, support for the fact that it seems to be inappropriate to take on that he took on this name, and it's not supposed to be used in the get. Okay, and to conclude, sort of this perspective, this side of the shir, that it seems to be inappropriate and something that we should avoid. I want to look at a tshuva of the Maram Shik, okay, in source number 9, and we'll see how he felt about this. So the Maram Shik lived in the 1800s in Hungary. And apparently, he actually chose the name Shik as his last name because it's an abbreviation for Shame Yisrael Kodesh, right? Apparently, in his community, the Jews were forced by the government to take on last names, right? To take on secular names, family names that were secular, and that's what chose to be his name as sort of a way of still keeping a Jewish name even within that law. Shik was supposed to be Shame Yisrael Kodesh. Okay, so he felt very, very strongly about this, against it, and he says it's an Israel Doraisa, it's a Torah violation to have a non-Jewish name. So if we look at, we'll start from the third line, we'll skip the introduction to the tshuva where he's talking about who he's writing to and the date, and we'll start from the third line in source 9. He says, Im amnam she'ein ani yodea lechanot oto, mikol makom ra'iti sh'ra'ui lahashiv al hadavar, Asher Sha'al Shayish Bnei Adam Shemechanim Atzmam B'Shem Hagoyim. Okay, so he's talking to the person that he's writing to, and he's saying that apparently there are people who take on non-Jewish nicknames, and that's what I'm being asked about. Okay, and then continuing, Re'umalato Ne'roya'ir Huchiachotam. So, and this person who's asking him the tshuva apparently reprimanded them. Zaharei Amru B'Midrash. And now I'm on 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm skipping to the fifth line, right? And it says, because it says in the Midrash, why were they reprimanded for doing this? Because of the Midrash that we saw. Shabeschut zeh shelosh shinu et shmam zachinu latzeit mimitzrayim. Because of in the merit of the fact that the Jewish people didn't change their names in Mitzrayim, that's why they deserved to leave Mitzrayim. And it should be enough for them to have a Jewish name to be called Bo'la'alot LaTorah. Okay, so, and he says that some of the people respond and say, it's enough for the person to have a Jewish name for which he's using, by which he's called to the Torah, and that qualifies as having a Jewish name. And then if you have another name also, that's fine. You would still be under the category of having not changed their names in Mitzrayim and be deserving of the Geula as long as you have a Jewish name and you use that Jewish name in some fashion, in some arena. You're called up to the Torah that way, so that's enough, right? And that would qualify. But the Maharam Shik is responding and he's saying, no way, right? He says, v'zedavar hevel v'tufshus, right? This is stupid, this is nonsense, ki bevada yish v'zed isr do reisa, because of course there's an isr do reisa, there's a Torah-level prohibition against doing this. Kemosh ha-kasef ha-Rambam, like the Rambam says, v'perikir aleph v'hilchus avodah zarah, which is the Rambam that we saw earlier in Hilchus avodah zarah, z'mikra milo malei ne'emar b'sof parashas kedoshim, v'avdil etchem min ha'amim liyos li, because the Midrash learns from the pasuk va'avdil etchem min ha'amim, that Hashem's going to separate the Jewish people from other nations to be for me, to be for Hashem. Umisham yalfinam b'sifrei, and from there the sifrei, the midrash halacha and sifrei vayikra, the ein rishayin ledamos lahem, learns from there that we're not allowed to be similar to the non-Jewish people, which is again what the Rambam said and what the Shulchan Aruch brought down based on the Rambam. B'shum open in any way, the kol shehu osel ledamos lahem over al mashan amar b'torah. And anything you do that's similar to non-Jews, you're violating this Torah prohibition of being similar to the non-Jews. Just like we can't be similar to the non-Jews in how we dress and how we walk and other practices, who had in the kol shekin, right, it's the same thing here with the names. The kol shekin to asur ledamos lahem b'shmam, and all the more so we can't be similar in our names. Va'alinu la'asos kemosh asu avosinu, and it's on us to do like our forefathers did in Mitzrayim. Shne'emar b'hem v'hisham l'goy gadol v'darshu chazal melamed shayu Yisrael mitzuyanim sham, that the Jewish people state were in Mitzrayim, but they kept themselves separate, and we need to do the same thing. We need to keep ourselves separate and not change our names. Okay, so we see from numerous sources why it might be a problem to change, to have a non-Jewish name, and we see support in the Gemara and in some responsa that it seems to be something criticized and something that we're not supposed to do, something we're supposed to avoid. Now, on the other hand, if we look through Shas, and we look through earlier sources, and we look through halakhic authorities over the generations, we'll see tons and tons of non-Jewish names, the Aramaic names, and right, Babylonian names and different names that are not Jewish, right? For example, if we look in source number 10 in the Yerushalmi, in the Gemara in the Yerushalmi, I don't want to get into the details of what this Gemara is about. The only reason I put this here is to show you the name of the Amora, the name of the Gemara figure who's talking here. Mishum Rabbi Yehuda bar Titus, right? Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Titus, Titus. Who's Titus? Right? He was the general who destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. Right, very non-Jewish name, and probably someone that we don't really like so much. Nonetheless, there were people who had, in the Jewish community, who had this name. And there's numerous, numerous others, right? Shmaya and Aptalion and numerous others. Yeah, question. Exactly, right? In the Purim story, we also know of people having non-Jewish names, and this seems to be very widespread, and not something that's necessarily criticized. We don't really hear criticism about it. So, it seems that it's not so simple. Okay, also, the Gemara in source 11 tells us that exactly what we just said, exactly what we know to be true. The Gemara even says it explicitly, right? The Gemara says, "Gitin habayim midinas hayam, the edim chasumim aleihem," that gitin that come from exile and witnesses are signs at the bottom of the get. Afal pi sheshmoseihen kishimos over the kochavim, even if the names of the witnesses are non-Jewish names, kishirin, the get is still kasher. But pnei sherov Yisrael shabechul, right? Most of the Jewish people in Chutz Aretz. Their names are non-Jewish names, right? And Gemara doesn't go on to say, and that's a bad thing, and we should try to fix that, and we're critical of that. It just is what it is. It's just a reality, and no one seems to have a problem with it. So, what's going on? Is it something that is that we're supposed to try to avoid, or is it just totally fine and it just is what it is? And right, so how do we reconcile these the reality, what seems to be the facts on the ground and the reality, with the sources that seem to imply that this is problematic? So one idea is that, right, in the case of Tosfos and in a lot of the case, in a lot of the halachos that we saw about what we're trying to avoid, we're trying, in Tosfos' case, it's a mumar lavodas kochavim, right? It's someone who's a heretic. It's someone who specifically was proactively going against the Torah, right? It's not about the secular name per se. It's that this person used to have a different name that he gave up. And why did he give it up? Because he's rejecting the Torah and rejecting Jewish belief, and putting this new name would sort of be an acknowledgement of that. Maybe that's the problem. It's not the name per se, but it's what it represents. And this is really the argument made in source number 12 by the Taz, the Turei Zahav commentary on Shulchan Aruch. And here he's making this comment on Evan Ha'ezer. And he says, Ulaniut Dati, in source number 12, Ulaniut Dati, in my humble opinion, Nira, the inhagnai misat etem shem zigiut, the tevar omahi, right? It's not the negativity associated with the non-Jewish name is not because of the inherent in the name itself. It's just letters. It's not a big deal. The ein ba chisaron, right? There's not really anything lacking with it. Baharbe shemot hagoyim krovim l'shemot shalanu. A lot of non-Jewish names are similar to Jewish names. Ella, rather, to kol shehemir hagoyim machlifim shem yahadut shalo v'notznim lo shem giyut l'havir hayahadut b'zeh. But rather, when someone is a heretic and they reject Judaism and they take on the non-Jewish name to kind of remove any Jewish soul that's left in them, any Jewish essence that's left in them, that's what's not appropriate to acknowledge and to put in the Jewish get, right, in the Jewish document. So that's really the problem, right? In Mitzrayim, they're not changing their name, if we look back at the Midrash, it wasn't just that. That was one piece of four things that they were praised for. It was that combined with other things that the Jewish people did to remain separate and remain different. And since it was before Matan Torah, which is what Rav Moshe Feinstein argues in the next source, right? That's all they had to keep themselves separate. What post Matan Torah, Rav Moshe Feinstein argues, we have Torah and mitzvos and belief in Torah and mitzvos and practice of halacha to keep us separate and maintain our Jewish identity. So the name becomes a lot less important, right? It's what it, in Mitzrayim, it's what it represents, and it's bigger piece of a bigger picture. It's one piece of a bigger picture that that's what made them deserving of the Geula. It's right, not just the name, not changing their names itself, but the fact that that was representing them maintaining their Jewish identity. So let's look at source number 12 inside, the Tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, where he talks about this as well. Right, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, "V'hine yish," I'm on source number 13 in the first line, "V'hine yish makom lomar d'zesh she'shibchu Chazal v'yikra Rabba b'alamid bet b'galut Mitzrayim." Right, so there's room to say that the fact that Chazal praised Bnei Yisrael in Mitzrayim, shaloshi knew at Shmotan, that they didn't change their names, who lekode matan Torah, it was before the giving of the Torah. Shalo haya heker gadol b'shvil kiyum hamitzvos. Right, so there was no great difference between the Jewish people and the non-Jewish people, such as observing the Torah. Right? In that time, many Jews actually worshipped the Egyptian gods. And a lot of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim didn't give their sons a bris. Right? Until closer to when they were going to leave Mitzrayim. Right? One of the halachos about the Karban Pesach is that someone who doesn't have a bris mitzvah is not allowed to eat the Karban Pesach. So only when it came close to the time they were leaving Mitzrayim, when the whole Karban Pesach situation was happening, they're going to have to give the Karban Pesach, and now they realize, okay, if we better get on board with this, otherwise we're not getting out of here. So then that's when they gave their sons a bris so that they could eat the Karban Pesach and identify with the Jewish community and be saved from Mitzrayim. Right, so Rav Moshe Feinstein says, "Umashma," it's implied. I'm on the third line of source 13, in the middle of the line. Shahaya rov gadol levad shevet Levi shehim malu es b'nayim. Aside from shevet Levi, there was a big majority that didn't give their sons a bris. Right, shevet Levi did k'tichsev uvrischayin soru b'birkas Moshe. It's implied in the bracha that Moshe gives to the Shvatim at the end of the Torah that shevet Levi was careful about this. Rashi tells us that many that were born in the desert didn't give their sons a bris, but this is apparently is true about in Mitzrayim also. Kemefurash b'midrashos, like it says in the midrash. Shalachin b'shvil ha'emuna shayigalu v'ratzu shayuni karin shehim Yisrael henhigu lahakpid shalo yishnu et shmam v'lo yishnu et leshonam. So Rav Moshe is saying, because they wanted to be associated with the Jewish community so that they could be deserving of getting out of Mitzrayim and be part of that community that was going to be redeemed from Mitzrayim, so they were careful about maintaining that identity of not changing their names, not changing their practice. But right, when we ta'am zesha yachzela ha-ge'ula, that's why specifically the Midrash says that they were deserving of ge'ula for this, because what were they doing by not changing their names and not changing their clothing? They were identifying with the community, and it was that community that Hashem decided He was going to take out of Mitzrayim. So if you identified with that community by doing something proactive or not doing something, then you were able to be part of that ge'ula. But right, once we have the Torah and mitzvos, then you don't, that was the way. Then that becomes the way of identifying with the Jewish community by practicing halacha, by believing in Torah and mitzvos. Then that becomes the way of identifying with the Jewish community, and the name becomes kind of secondary. Okay, which is what he says about achar matan Torah. And I'm, let's see, 6 lines up from the bottom now, in the middle of the line. Aval achar in source 13, aval achar matan Torah, ein lanu chiyuv midina, v'gam lo me'inyanei zehirudu musar, ela shematzavinu hatarag mitzvot adorot. We don't have to be careful about these other things except for what's part of the 613 mitzvot. And not having non-Jewish names, Rav Moshe Feinstein's arguing, is not one of those things. So it's totally fine, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, to have a non-Jewish name, because we have other ways of identifying, of maintaining our Jewish identity. Okay, I want to skip source 14 for now. We'll possibly come back to it later. Let's go on to source 15, where we go back to the tshuva that we read before about the Murano crypto-Jews in Portugal from the Maharsha Adam. And so that's tshuva that we referenced before, he also concludes that it's not a problem to have a non-Jewish name, right? So he says, al pi ha'emet, kol ma she'osrim u'machmirim ha'poskim, eino ela shelo yishana adam atzmo v'gufo v'pnei ha'goy, shelo yachshavu v'legoy v'yomru v'yiru be'etzba ze goyu, right? So everything that's not allowed by the poskim is that someone shouldn't actually change himself and change his ways in front of a non-Jew, so that the non-Jews really think that he's a non-Jew, and they would point to him and say, "You're a non-Jew." The ikochil Hashem, and then there would be a desecration of Hashem's name. Aval b'masha kosev tzracha v'achar kachosev shmo k'shem goy. Right, but if he's writing his business documents and afterwards he's signing it with a non-Jewish name, umisha nishtal elav hakosev yodeya bevadei shehu yehudi, and the other person knows that he's a Jew. Even if someone else who later sees this, who just sees the name, wouldn't necessarily know that they belong to someone Jewish, these whatever business happened with this document. They don't know the actual person. None of this is in public, it's all in a document. So you also don't need to worry about chilul Hashem, right, of desecrating God's name. So he says that he concludes in his tshuva that it's fine. It's totally fine to have these Portuguese Jews who became crypto Jews, and then when they went back to the Jewish community, they wanted to still use their non-Jewish names on their legal documents. He says it's totally fine, not a problem at all. It's not them considering them, it's not as if they're calling themselves non-Jews. Everybody, whoever's doing the business transaction with them knows who they are. And again, once they're outwardly practicing halachic Jews, then they're maintaining that identity, and it doesn't matter what name they're using on the paper. Okay, and what I think, the bottom line is here is that the important value here is the Jewish identity and the identifying with the Jewish community and with Jewish practice. And Bnei Yisrael and Mitzrayim kept their Jewish identity, and their names were part of that because there wasn't so much else to it. But when the Jews are rooted in Torah and a Jewish identity is strong, then having a secular name doesn't matter so much. And the last thing I wanted to conclude with is I think that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein really frames this idea nicely in his analysis of the case of Brother Daniel. So the case of Brother Daniel was about a Jew who became a Catholic priest and then applied for Israeli citizenship under the law of return, right? He had originally been a Jew, but he became a Catholic priest, but then wanted to move to Israel and become an Israeli citizen under the law of return. And Rav Lichtenstein, this case went to the Israeli Supreme Court, And Rav Lichtenstein wrote a seminal essay that's now published in the Leaves of Faith, but was originally published in the, where I quoted it from here, right, Judaism, a quarterly journal of Jewish life and thought, about this case. And he was talking about the issue of what does it mean to be a Jew, a Jewish identity? Is it true once a Jew, always a Jew, or not? So if we look at source 16, right, the Gemara in Yuvamos is talking about a case of a convert, right? An apostate, right? Someone who was Jewish and converted out of Judaism, so to speak, and rejected Judaism. But then he comes back and marries a Jew, right? Marries a Jewish woman, right? To Hazarbay, if he reneges on his apostate status from the Kadesh Bas Yisrael, and he tries to marry a Jewish woman, again, source 16, Yisrael Mumar Karina Bay Vikidushav Kidushin. We still call him a Yisrael. We call him a Yisrael Mumar, right? We call him an apostate Jew, but we still call him a Jew, and therefore his Kidushin, his marriage, is considered a valid marriage. We do have to consider this marriage a valid marriage. They would halakhically be considered married, and things would have to proceed from there. So this source seems to support the idea that once a Jew, always a Jew, even if he's an apostate, even if he rejected Judaism, Jewish practice, he's still considered a Jew. Right? That's on the one hand. On the other hand, if we look at source 17, elsewhere in the Gemara in Yevamot, the Gemara is talking about a case of the Samaritans. Someone who comes from one of the 10 lost tribes. So if the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav Asi, in source 17, Ove kuchavim shakidish bizman hazeh, if a non-Jewish man tries to marry a Jewish woman nowadays, right, in the times of the Gemara, choshishin l'kidushin, we have to suspect that maybe that kidushin really is valid, maybe that marriage really is considered a valid marriage, even though normally you can't have a marriage between a non-Jew and a Jew, but the Gemara is saying now we have to maybe account for the possibility that maybe this is a valid marriage. Why? Maybe this non-Jewish man really descends many generations earlier from the 10 lost tribes. Right, in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, there were two kingdoms, right, Malchut Yehuda, Malchut Yisrael, and Sanchirev exiled Malchut Yisrael, and all those people kind of just dispersed them in the world, and they kind of were lost. We weren't able to trace their lineage anymore. But they were originally from the Jewish people. So the Gemara is saying maybe this non-Jewish man in front of us right now, maybe he's from the 10 lost tribes, and really he has some Jewish lineage. So we have to account for the possibility that his marriage to this Jewish woman is valid, and we can't let her marry somebody else without a proper get, right, without a divorce. But the Gemara ends up concluding there. Ika da Amri, right, in response, there are those who say, one of the responses to this was, Ki Amrite Kamei de Shmuel, when this was brought in front of the Amora Shmuel, Amar Lei, Lo Zazu Misham Adcha Sa'um of Nikhu Chavim Gumurim, right? They didn't move from there, from that place, until they made the descendants of the lost tribes into absolute Gentiles. So, what he's basically saying here is that eventually, at some point, those descendants of the lost tribe did start to be considered absolute non-Jews, right? Absolute Gentiles. And we don't have to worry about this marriage of this non-Jew in front of us today to this Jewish woman that is possibly a Jewish marriage. So on the one hand, the first source says that an apostate Jew, his marriage still counts. But on the other hand, a non-Jew, we don't have to be concerned that he comes from the 10 lost tribes. So on the one hand, it seems like once a Jew, always a Jew, and you can't really get rid of that Jewish identity. And on the other hand, it seems like at some point there is a limit and there is a line, and we don't consider any non-Jew to be a possible descendant of the 10 lost tribes. So what's going on here? Is Jewish identity preserved forever or not? So Reb Chaim Brisker, in his comments on the Rambam, he tries to resolve this contradiction, and I didn't bring the source inside, but I'll just explain it. He tries to resolve this contradiction, and he says that the two texts, the two different Gemaras that we saw in Yuvamos, apply to two different scenarios. Right? One describes a convert, an apostate, who originally rejected Judaism and then returns to, is trying to return to his Jewish practices. And that's what Rav Lichtenstein summarizes Rav Chaim Brisker's argument as he calls it an apostate of action, right? If we look at source 18, right, Rav Lichtenstein summarizes this idea. He says there is an apostasy, not, he's, first he says there's an apostasy of action, But then, right, and those violations are serious violations, and they have serious consequences, but it's not a shaking of the core identity, right, he says. But the Samaritans, right, and the descendants of the 10 lost tribes, they belong to an entirely different category, Rav Chaim argues. They gave up their personal identities as Jews. They don't associate or identify with the Jewish community at all anymore, right? And it's not just their personal status, but it's really a complete dissociation. And when absolutely no connection to Jewish roots remain, then that Jewishness is lost completely, and it is, that tie is severed, right? So if we look at source 18, where Rav Lichtenstein summarizes this, he says there's an apostasy not of action, but of person, and estrangement manifested not merely by the commission of various sins, but by the complete severance of personal bonds with Jewry, right? So there is the apostasy of action. That's the one in the first source, in Yevamos, where we do consider his marriage valid, where he doesn't, right, reject his, he doesn't sever his ties completely per se, but he is doing non-Jewish actions. But then there's also the apostasy of person, where there you completely sever the ties with Judaism and Jewry, right? By total alienation from the Jewish people, I'm continuing in source 18, and its history as a spiritual and physical community, and finally by thorough assimilation into the mainstream Gentile society. So when that happens, then that person's Jewishness is completely gone, the tie is completely severed, and we don't consider that person's marriage to a Jew valid anymore, right? So, and this is sort of phrased in the negative, but I think in the positive, it asks the Jew to remain, what's important to maintain the Jewish identity and to sort of have in place the once a Jew, always a Jew, is that connection to the Jewish people, to the Jewish historical experience, to practicing Judaism, and that connect, that rootedness and that connection and that identifying as a Jew is what makes someone continue to be a Jew, sort of even if their actions are not always in line. And in Mitzrayim, right, keeping their Jewish names was part of maintaining that otherness, that separation. But once we're rooted in our unique identity in many other ways, like we said before, the names become unimportant. And I think our goal, sort of the takeaway from this that I want to end with, is that our goal should be to focus on our commitment to Torah and our commitment to mitzvot and viewing ourselves as part of a collective Jewish community. And as Rav Lichtenstein says in the next paragraph, I think we could sort of look at this from a more positive perspective, maintaining our spiritual identification. So I'll just close with this, where he says, right, source 19, Rav Lichtenstein says, halachic discourse and philosophic analysis, and this is sort of a conclusion of the whole article where he's discussing halacha, he's discussing the philosophy of what makes a Jew, right, thus arrive at the same conclusion as they departed from the same terminal. So halacha and philosophy bring us to the same place. Kedushat Yisrael may be a native endowment, but it is not an irrevocable patrimony, right? It might be something that we get, but it's not something that's irrevocable. It is received, but it must also be taken, and it can be thrown away, right? It is something that we get, but we have to also proactively maintain that identity, or else it ceases. It courses through the veins, but it must also be lodged in the heart. For above all, Kedushat Yisrael carries with it a spiritual challenge. As chosenness is, collectively, as much a responsibility as a privilege, so Kedushat Yisrael calls upon the individual Jew to live up to his status. It is a position to be attained as much as a gift to be enjoyed. Hence, if it is to be retained at all, there must be a minimum of spiritual identification. And that's what not changing their names, I think, in Mitzrayim allowed for when they didn't have anything else. But the ideal, of course, is beyond fulfillment. The heights to which Kedushat Yisrael calls the Jews are immeasurable. The mountain of the Lord is infinitely high. So the minimum is to maintain that spiritual identification. But of course, we're supposed to strive for more than that and strive for growth and rootedness and connection to Torah and mitzvot through practice, through observance, through belief. But at this point, when we have all of that, then the names become less important. And I think the conclusion, halachically speaking, is that, right, having a non-Jewish name is not a problem. But hopefully, with whatever name we have, we have strong Jewish identity that we're able to pass on to the next generation. Again, thank you so much for learning with me today. Have a good rest of the day. Stay warm.